Welcome to episode 4 of the Leadership Educator Podcast. My name is Dan Jenkins, and I am Chair and Associate Professor of Leadership and Organizational Studies at the University of Southern Maine.
And I am Lauren Bullock, Assistant Professor of Instruction at Temple University, and we're excited for you to join us today on the Leadership Educators Podcast. Today, we're going to talk about one of my favorite things, which is running a leadership office, or at least getting started with running a leadership office.
Yeah, so Lauren, before moving over to faculty at Temple, you ran the Office of Leadership Development there for 6 years. You're responsible for executing the mission, the vision, scheduling workshops and conferences, handling all of the financial tasks, including managing the budget, as well as recruiting students to participate. I mean, wow, that sounds like a lot of work. So after you were hired, what were some of the things that that you got started?
Sure. So it was a lot of work. It was great because I managed so many things and felt very entrepreneurial. I had to recruit students, plan events, pay for everything, assess it, and institute curriculum. When I first started with the job, I didn't think all of that was included. But as I started to learn more, I learned that half of my job was administrative and then the other half was centered on leadership. I was fortunate that I had part-time staff with me, but I was the only full-time person. And so that left me responsible for everything related to the office. I had about 3 weeks between the time I accepted the job and started working officially in that office and in that capacity. And so in that time, the first thing I did was read a book on how to be successful in your first 100 days of your new job. So while I was experienced at Temple and I had worked in higher ed for 9 years and had worked for 4 years as a coordinator with a boss who was very hands-on and said, let me teach you all of these things so that when you run your own office, you know how to run your own office. I was fortunate that I had that, but I was still responsible for all of the decision-making for an office. The umbrella that I'd had as a coordinator was really removed, and now all of that fell into my lap. So in the book, the author shared that some of the best things you can do when you get started is first identifying the important people in the office that you'll need to know, understanding how the office operates, so what systems are in place to keep everything going, and then setting short-term goals or plans so that in the immediate future, you kind of take care of what you need to take care of. So I didn't think about what our office looked like 5 years out. Even though, according to StrengthsFinder, I'm futuristic and strategic, I held off on that. Mm-hmm. But I focused on, in that short term, like, what are the best things I can do to keep the office going and make it so that the students and faculty and administrators that were involved couldn't miss a beat in terms of that programming. I'll say this, for the first 6 months, I met with everybody on the list I created. I asked a lot of questions about operations and philosophy and suggestions and other people to contact. I listened to everybody that was involved in the program so I could get a really good sense of what was happening and what people loved and what we could change that would increase the number of students, faculty, and administrators we were reaching. I was a little bit of a ringer in that I wasn't a complete newcomer. I had volunteered for workshops and I worked at the leadership conference before I took over the office when I was still a coordinator. But there was still a lot to learn. Also, because I was an internal candidate, I knew some of the people on the list that I was supposed to meet, but I still asked those questions, like just to make sure I was meeting with the right people and I didn't miss anybody. I think one of the best pieces of advice I've received going into that job was, listen to those that are close to the program before you make any decisions about what you're going to do.
Yeah, no, I think that's great advice that works across any platform. In particular, your process of making lists of the key individuals that you wanted to make sure to connect with early on. I know that having worked in academic advising and in the College of Undergraduate Studies when I was a doc student at the University of South Florida, it was really important that we had a network and collaboration and a connection with. Not only the other colleges and majors on campus, but the registrar, financial aid, community and service learning, student affairs, residence life, you name it. And so I took some of that experience when I became tenure track faculty at USM, and I got a lot of interesting responses from folks in other areas of campus. I said, "Why do you want to meet with us?" I said, "Well, this is what I did when I was in a role, as a doc student and more of a kind of entry level academic affairs administration, but not faculty." And a lot of them said, "Faculty don't usually do this." I said, "Well, I'm doing this," and I've really been able to make some key connections, I think, you know, because of that. And I often will, you know, anytime that there's a new hire, you know, at the administrative level of the university, and there's been quite a few lately, you know, I try to make those connections. Let's meet for coffee. You know, I'm just curious where they're coming from. I mean, everybody's people, you know, and what are some of the perspectives that they're bringing? And I, you know, and in the end, you know, that's helpful for the department, because, you know, we have that network.
Absolutely. So one of the things, the people on that list included a few faculty members who, even when I transitioned to faculty, helped me with that transition. So not only were they instrumental in helping me get the office, you know, going and ensuring that the transition between leadership of the office was safe and great, they also helped me personally and professionally in moving from an administrator to faculty. But I love that you talk about, even in your faculty role, you went back and you still kept those relationships and partnerships. I did the same thing and have encouraged my predecessor to do that, simply because we're all doing very similar work. And with time and resources being constrained in some places, let's keep the relationships going that really support our work. And also, students don't really see a difference between faculty and administrator and staff member. They just know you work here at the university and you're supposed to help them out. And if we can, you know, remove some of those barriers, it makes it that much easier. I'll say that after my first 6 months of just listening to everybody, I felt so much more comfortable making plans for future years. And I think had I tried to do that in my first month, it would have been a challenge, because I didn't have enough of a grasp of what the office was actually doing, and didn't have enough like firsthand in the trenches experience in what the office was doing, where I would have felt comfortable with those decisions. And again, since I was an office of one, it wasn't like I could look to another full-time staff member, because I was the only person in that office. I did say this, that first academic year, so from July 1st to June 30th, I promised myself that I would only change things that were truly broken within the system and run every program as close as I could to how it had been run in the past, to ensure that I could identify what things worked and what didn't work, in addition to listening to some of the things that people said worked and didn't work. I had my own experience, and then I also had that backup of what I'd gained in talking to other folks. I'll say that after my first year, I felt confident in making some changes that would address some of the concerns that our stakeholders had. For example, students enjoyed our programs, and when I took over the department, there wasn't a way for them to stay involved for multiple years unless they went from a little commitment to an extreme commitment. And so one of the things I did, and was in line with best practices at the time, was I implemented a tiered leadership program so that students could grow in their development and leadership as they were growing in their experience or moving forward and, you know, getting credits in their major. At the time, I remember that the university had comparison schools and our division had comparison schools, but I didn't see anything in our records that showed where our department had them. And so it was great, because I was looking at tiered programs that we could model our program after, and those helped me define some schools that would fit into our demographic.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely important to, you know, to not only benchmark, but, you know, to compare and to learn. I really appreciate, you know, how, you know, systemically, you know, kind of focused you were with, you know, thinking short term, thinking long term, and going back to, you know, what you had said a few minutes ago about, you know, identifying those key individuals across campus, because it's not just the task, it's the relationships, you know. And if you're going to try and approach, you know, these, whether it be, you know, tweaking a program, developing a program, you know, evolving a program, you know, you don't want to, you know, be too Machiavellian about it, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, you know, slowly, you know, start to implement things based on, you know, your own strengths and the strengths of your staff. And I think that that really goes a long way. And certainly based on what you shared, I think that, you know, it sounds like you were very successful in doing that. You know, what else helped as you were going through that transition early on?
I'll say one thing was important. The person who created that department did a wonderful job. And so I didn't want to ignore the great work that they had done. I just kept asking the question, like, how can we make this better? And how can we change as our students are changing? And one of the things that was super beneficial was attending some of the leadership conferences. I could talk to representatives from the schools that I, you know, watched from afar and used as benchmarks. And I could also learn from the speakers on how best practices and the trends applied to our school. So I remember attending LEI and connecting with my student affairs friends. And then a few years later, attending the Leadership Educators Conference and connecting with both student and faculty members. It was actually at LEI where I purchased the Handbook for Student Leadership Development and heard Susan Colmavez speak about the history of the industry. I'll say, if you're a leadership educator anywhere, especially if you're running a curricular program, but anywhere, the one book you need on your desk is the Handbook for Student Leadership Development by Colmavez, Dugan, Owen, Slack, Wagner, and Associates. The authors in that text wrote about the history of leadership development. They wrote about program design, context, delivery, and also how can you assess your programs. You know, you can choose any chapter in that text and whatever you need in that moment and apply it to your operations. And so once I found out that that book existed, you know, I poured through that thing like it was my own personal Bible and it was going to outline the rest of my life. I just really dug into it because it was such a well-researched, valuable resource that I hadn't come across yet. But once I found it, I knew it could be instrumental in answering some of the questions that my colleagues at my school didn't know, as well as some of the information or things that I didn't know. That was a super useful resource.
Yeah, you know, as you talk about some of those, you know, early resources for programs, absolutely that one. I remember, as we talked about in a previous episode, finding that instructor's guide for that book on exploring leadership for college students who want to make a difference. And to the evolution of leadership programs and, you know, kind of what are the standards, what are the guidelines? You had me thinking about the CAS standards or the mm-hmm. Let's see the acronym mm-hmm. for that, the Council mm-hmm. for the Advancement of Standards in Higher Education. They have a specific list of standards that are the student leadership program standards. I think they're really, really close to a version 3.0 or 4.0 or revising mm-hmm. these standards. But I know that one of the most recent version of it, I know that Susan Colmavez, who you mentioned, was one of the individuals on that committee, and they put some effort into create or to add a synopsis of the history of leadership programs in higher education. And so they talk a little bit about that evolution through the 70s and 80s, and some of the, you know, the meetings of the minds, and you know, and how this idea of some things that were really going on the edges of leadership programming and student affairs became more formalized during that time. And there's just some great resources within, you know, that document, not just on the history and evolution, but also on that you might use to measure the learning outcomes or think about the different types of, you know, areas and the ethics and the programming and the access and the technology mm-hmm. and things of that nature that are all, mm-hmm. you know, encompassed within with running a program or you know, starting a new office.
Yeah, I agree 100%, especially with the CAS standards. We, during my fourth or fifth year, we started a strategic plan in our division, and the CAS standards were introduced into that project for our office for the first time in a formal professional manner. So I knew they exist, and we had had some conversation around CAS standards in different ways, but in that strategic plan, they were formalized into the work that we did. And I remember it was such a great learning experience for my graduate students. I had two who were working on master's degrees in higher education. And so they talked about CAS standards in their research class, but to have a project that connected their work to their education, I think was super useful for them and something that I didn't have when I was, going through my advanced education. One of the things that, I'll share is I have, you know, two degrees or a background in public relations and marketing and sports. And so most of my leadership learning was very self-directed. So I'd been a coordinator in student activities. And so I was immersed in the experiential part of that, but the formal education had to come through me taking some classes and now me getting my doctorate. And so one of the things that I appreciated about our office at the time was I knew that because I didn't have that learning experience, any student who came through my office was going to get those learning experiences and making sure that our experience aligned with what higher education programs consider to be best practice. And I think that's something that's increasing. I know when I was at LEI, I think in 2012 at Ohio State, remember this guy standing up and saying, I don't know if I can be a leadership educator because I didn't get a leadership education degree. And Susan Colmavez was kind of like, newsflash, like a lot of us didn't. But the cool thing is we have these events, we have these resources that we continue to share that are able to help us connect that theory to practice. And we get into these spaces and we have these conversations about that. And that's where we get that further learning. So yeah, I think that was, I hate to say I love CAS standards because it sounds so corny, but they're so super helpful among some other things that we have available to us.
Yeah. And you wouldn't be the only one that doesn't have a degree in leadership education. I mean, there really aren't very many at all. There's a few, you know, terminal degree programs in some of the agricultural leadership, extension education areas, some of the land grant institutions that have a specialization in leadership education. I think Texas A&M, Nebraska, University of Florida come to mind. But, you know, we're right on the, you know, the fringe of, it's very, very, very early. I know we just added a graduate leadership certificate in professional leadership education at my university. In response to that, I was listening to Trisha Teig, who's faculty at University of Denver. She had done her dissertation on looking at the professional development and, you know, the availability of some of the formal courses at the master's level in student affairs programs and counselor ed types of programs, student personnel, if you will, that are, you know, preparing, future student affairs professionals. And she found very, very little and interviewed both students in those programs and faculty that teach in those programs. And they kind of said, well, you know, they can go out and get that training on their own if they want it. Why don't they go to ILA or LEI or, or some of these other programs, you know, and that's one of the, you know, reasons that the Leadership Education Academy has been so successful at the ILA program. And, I think that there will be some more programs over the next few years because this field is growing. But yeah, you are amongst friends if you don't have a terminal degree in leadership or a related field, yeah. or have gone through any type of formalized training to learn how to do this.
Yeah. Well, I think it speaks volumes, though, to the interdisciplinary nature of our industry. You can come from anywhere, and leadership is needed everywhere. And it's generally about being a self-directed learner and continuing to pursue information and continuing to be curious and ask questions about leadership development and how it's changing. I think that's what makes a great leadership educator. You're just continually asking that question. You know, does this apply still? Now does this apply? You know, we look at Kuz and Posner. It's 30 plus years old, and we're still looking at how is this applicable and how has it stood, you know, the test of time. I'll say one of the biggest things I learned early on was to not just look at my student affairs colleagues, but also look at faculty members about applying theory and models to practice. I remember my first ALE, I attended so many faculty sessions because I wanted to see what the other side of the curtain, the academic curtain, looked like. You know, like I said, I didn't graduate from a leadership academic program, so most of my learning was self-directed. And I now have the benefit of learning about leadership through a formalized academic program as a doctoral student at Antioch University. But I'm also learning that, like I also learned at that faculty session, like there's so much information out there. And I just kept asking the question, how can I use this information in student affairs? I found that it was quite easy because most of the research supported what we already knew to be true about leadership. And because we had so many researchers who were publishing about student affairs, you know, the information was out there, and those conferences brought the opportunity to have conversations in person and maybe ask the questions that you couldn't garner from the readings. I just remember thinking how excited I was to attend those conferences because I could talk about those leadership concepts in a way that I could bring that information back and truly apply it to the department and what we were trying to do.
Yeah. And, you know, I've shared this with you before, Lauren, that, you know, one of the reasons that I, you know, have, you know, returned to NASPA conferences and LEI, which is, you know, the vast majority of the attendees and participants are in student affairs roles versus faculty roles, or they're faculty that teach in student affairs programs. So I tend to be the odd man out more often than not, but I'm doing the same thing. I'm going to sessions from that student affairs professionals are facilitating on, you know, innovative learning activities and programs that they're doing, you know, in their areas. And I'm bringing that back to my academic classrooms because, you know, there is innovation going on all the time and on both sides, you know, and it's, I love any opportunity where those, you know, two areas come together. You know, there's so mm-hmm. much that mm-hmm. we do in common. doesn't matter to me that one group is doing it for credit and one's not is doing it not for credit. Like it's the content is so similar. The pedagogy mm-hmm. is very similar. You know, it's just being facilitated by people from different experience levels, and not even experience levels, just with different experiences and coming from, you know, at it from a different angle and a different context on campus. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely agree. I think the delivery looks different, but the content is very much similar. And it's interesting you say that, because I spent so much time early on learning about leadership. But the biggest thing I think that surprised people when I would talk to them about my work is most of my job was administrative. So I started out, luckily, as a business major. So I was marketing major and a public relations minor before I switched into sports PR. And I found myself using those first 2 years of college, like the classes and material and theories that I learned from the first 2 years in school, to run the office. The bulk of our engagement was through workshops and conferences. And so most of my job was aligned more with being a manager, you know, and I would tell my students that, like, you have to be a leader and a manager sometimes. And they're like, no, you promote leadership. And I'm like, yeah, but also you got to pay the bills. You know, you got to make sure things are organized. And so, like, in my old job, I had to order rooms and food, submit contracts, and work with accounts payable to get those contracts paid. You know, I had to find the appropriate marketing materials and get our name out to students and just manage a number of tasks that people don't normally think about with leadership development programs. I think, fortunately, I have a strong entrepreneurial spirit, and I think that was super helpful in running the office, because I didn't have a feeder of students coming through, like, you know, a certain academic program or another place in the university. You know, I had to go out there and work hard to get every student in the door. One of the things that also was shifting a little bit, and I look at this in my own research, is we used to be able to put up a flyer and students would attend because they saw the flyer. And we had to move towards a model where we had to persuade students why leadership mattered and why they had to come to our programs to learn how to be better leaders. I felt like I was fighting sometimes with students, because I'm like, I know this is helpful and I know you know leadership is important because I know you wrote about it on your application to get in here. But then they get in school and be like, well, I'm in this student organization, that's enough. That's good. And I'm like, wonderful. But our programs give you this opportunity to process that experience and reflect so that you can be better for yourself and then lead those same student org members, you know, at a higher or better level. And, you know, we used to market or persuade students, say, you know, this gives you a space to figure it out without all the pressure from your peers about being involved in learning and growing. So come talk to us about your experience. We'll help you figure it out. And then you can go back and you can be an even better leader in that group. But again, a lot of people were surprised to know that a lot of my job was, you know, pushing papers and, you know, making sure that everybody got paid and all the rooms were, you know, properly assigned and the calendar was managed. And I think that because my mentor in a prior job had set me up where she knew I could run that part, when it came time to take over the office, I knew I could manage the flow, like the systems. I had to learn so much more about what it meant to be a leadership educator. Yeah, but most people are always surprised about that.
Yeah, no, it's a lot of moving parts. And, you know, to your point about, you know, the systems, and we were talking a little bit earlier about, you know, just, you know, thinking systemically and, you know, being able to have that adaptive leadership lens and understand that these are complex challenges that, you know, aren't going to be, you know, easily answered with, you know, technical solutions, if you will. And, you know, really, you know, taking into account, you know, not only the financial, the paper pushing part of it, but the mm-hmm. relationships and the students and the different stakeholders that you have. What's some other, you know, advice that you've learned along the way as you were, you know, starting up, or for someone that might be taking over a leadership program?
Mm-hmm. I think I have three things. So for anybody taking over a leadership program, the first thing is define leadership in your office and then explore how campus and professional partners define leadership. There's some programs out there that have done a great job of establishing an institutional definition and garnering or getting other units to use that definition. What it does is it creates cohesion among the students, and they know that when they're going through these different experiences, that there's a very similar understanding of what leadership means. And that's one thing that I wish I had known early on, because I would have worked to establish that and then establish some partnerships out of that. I think the second thing I would do would be to encourage leadership educators to reach out to other schools and get ideas on how you can continue to engage students in learn leadership learning. With so many resources on campus, you know, you're fighting against all the flyers, all of the slideshows, like you're fighting against so many things. How can you get your office out there or department or program out there? The thing is, you have to be creative and persuasive in recruiting, but you don't have to recreate the wheel. And I remember regularly meeting with colleagues to get coffee and just discuss what were they doing that worked and how could we take that and apply it at our school. I know prior to joining Student Affairs, I worked in public relations, and one of the more valuable things I took from my PR education was how can I communicate my program's value in a few talking points to students. So it wasn't about leadership is this amazing thing that you should do, but it's what matters to them and how does leadership help make their job easier. My PR background helped me think about it from a very different perspective. And at the time, I remember it wasn't a popular approach with my colleagues, but I think now that we've had to justify our value more and more, it makes so much sense now. But 10 years ago, I don't think people were thinking about that. So I would connect, you know, like we used to do a program called Leading When Your Friends Are Your Followers to help get students in, because we knew students had to manage these relationships with their friends and didn't know how to. So if we got them in the door for our program, more than likely they would return. And so we knew that was a great way to get them in, have this conversation, give them a little bit, and then say, hey, we've also got these other things we can help you out with. Come on back. And so those were the things that we had to do and be creative about doing it. I think the last thing I would encourage people to do is get training in an area that's not leadership development. So a colleague of mine shared this, and when he said it, I had one of those Oprah aha moments. You know, and I remember thinking it was very simple advice, but it was very good advice. So for example, today I regularly attend teaching workshops at my school and have submitted a few proposals to non-leadership conferences to grow my knowledge in diversity and inclusion. So I value it, and I know it's important and it's being talked about in leadership, but what does it look like? What does that conversation look like outside of our industry? And so I even think about going to research conferences or business operations conferences or just anything that looks slightly interesting and will help me develop a skill set that's not directly related to leadership development. So I know those are some of the things I would share with people getting ready, either thinking about starting a leadership office, running one now, or, you know, hoping that that's their job in the future. I think those are some of the things that I would suggest, but I'm sure if you ask me, I have more in the tank. You know, I could talk. I have more.
I know you can. So, no, that's really, really sound advice. You know, I couldn't agree more. You know, get out of your comfort zone and go check out different conferences, different professional events, things in your community, other lectures and things going on perhaps at your university or at a neighboring university. So yeah, so you've shared some great tips on how leadership educators that are running co-curricular offices can set themselves up for success. So, you know, thank you so much for taking the lead on the podcast today and sharing your experiences with our audience. And thank you to our listeners as well for joining us and supporting us on our journey of becoming and being leadership educator podcasters. You can connect with us on Twitter. I'm at @Dr_Leadership, and Lauren is at @MRSLAURJB. So we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Leadership Educator Podcast, and we'd like to also thank the James M. Cox Jr. Institute for Journalism, Innovation, Management, and Leadership within the Grady College of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Georgia, facilitated by Dr. Keith Herndon, who's the William S. Morris Chair in News Strategy and Management.
Our wonderful theme music was composed, performed, and mixed by Dr. Matthew White, trumpeter, composer, and educator, who is currently an associate professor of trumpet, coordinator of jazz and commercial music, and director of ensembles at Coastal Carolina University. Check him out at www.mattwhitejazz.com. Matt, thank you so much for sharing your musical genius with our audience.
And finally, thank you to the Association of Leadership Educators. Check out the ALE and all they have to offer at leadershipeducators.org. And we hope you'll listen to our next episode wherever you get your podcasts. Mm-hmm.